that Los Angeles sunshine coming through.
Please stand by. Prime Video and Westworld director Jonathan Nolan invite you to Fallout.
After 200 years, we don't know much about what's up there. Violence, desperation, lawlessness.
Everyone wants to save the world, they just disagree on how.
We're gonna get across that wasteland, and we're gonna do it together.
Fallout. All episodes available now on Prime Video.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated / Tennis Channel Tennis Podcast. Another in-studio guest. Lower Manhattan resident. Renee Stubbs has swung by the studio. Have you been? You've been here before, haven't you?
Yeah.
New Yorker.
I'm here about
Renee
as much
Stubbs.
As you, apparently.
Don't tell anyone that. Nice to see you.
Yeah, good to see you.
So you are here, you know why? Because off-court matters are, I think, taking up way too much bandwidth and oxygen these days, and these last few days in particular. We can talk about that maybe later on, but I feel like I want to zig where the world is zagging. How about we actually talk tennis? How about we actually talk about athletes hitting a ball over a net and not
let's do that.
Unfortunate political matters? So we can touch on some of these topics maybe later on, but I thought we would actually talk tennis. I feel very bad for Petra Kvitova and Dominic Thiem, who had two terrific weeks last week. It coincided with a lot of ATP politics and a very unpleasant situation. We won't beat around the bush about Justin Gimelstob, but I feel like way too much attention has been diverted on account of that away from tennis. So this is an attempt to swing things back. So I thought you'd be a great person to actually talk some ball with and not
well, you know me,
governance.
John. Let's be honest. I could you pretty much throw anything at me, and I'm happy to talk
about
it.
That's why we love you. So let's talk tennis. Let's start with the men. Been a bit of a strange year so far. Does Rafa Nadal win the French Open?
Well, believe it or not, he's not my favorite. I think that Dominic Thiem is, and I would not have said that. I would not have said that prior to the start of the season. The only caveat for me is Rome. Rome for me has always been the catalyst of the tournament that for me shows who is playing at their very best on clay for Paris, because I've always found that Rome is the closest clay as far as speed and weather is concerned to Paris. So I'll keep a sort of a little bit of an asterisk on Rafa's name until after Rome, and then I'll wait and see what happens there. If he wins Rome, then I'll certainly put him back as favorite. But right now, I mean, I think Dominic Thiem has kind of sort of let everybody know. I've said last year that there's no doubt in my mind that Dominic Thiem's going to win the French. It's just a matter of when. And I think after the year that he's had with Indian Wells and then just what he did last week, I think that he's kind of letting people know that he actually believes in himself now. And that's part of the issue, is just starting to learn how to play these big matches. Look, I mean, Djokovic is certainly going to be probably equal favorite now, with Rafa not being at his best. But, hey, listen, it wouldn't surprise me if Rafa wins 12.
That's a bold statement. What about best of three versus best of five?
Well, you know how I feel about that. I mean, I've publicly said this many times.
I don't mean as a discussion point. I just mean relative to Dominic Thiem, and like beating a guy in 4-4 in Barcelona is one thing, but get out there for best of five, it's a different mentality.
100%. I mean, it's been one of the reasons why the guys have been so these particular guys have been so dominant at Grand Slams, is that to beat them over five sets is a whole different story. I mean, you can mentally wrap your head around, can I get an hour and a half of my best tennis out of myself today to win this final? Can I win a 4-4? Can I win 6-4 in the third? Whereas going five sets against someone like Rafa or Novak or Roger is, I mean, that's a bear, right? That's a bear to win three sets against three of the greatest players of all time. But I think that, you know, look, he made the final last year at the French. So he knows how to get to a final, and it's a navigating
You're talking about Thiem.
I'm talking about Dominic Thiem, right. Yeah. I mean, you can, once you get through a final, and he certainly beat some great players to get to the final last year, I think it was overwhelming in the final. I mean, playing the greatest clay court player of all time over five sets. But now I think mentally he thinks that he can do it, and that's such a big deal, John. Mentally.
Well, let me, so talk about Rafa with that, because I think, look, when Rafa isn't 100% healthy, usually you can tell, you can see it in his court positioning, you can see it with miles per hour on his serve. I'm not convinced that this isn't more, and I think it's crass to say mental versus physical. I think there's a lot of overlap, and I think the physical can lead to the mental. But what's interesting about Rafa these last few weeks is that it doesn't appear as though he's injured.
Well, I've also heard different opinions about that. I've heard him, you know, he's practicing and he's sort of, you know, throwing his head around and he's sort of complaining about his wrist a little bit. So there's conflicting arguments on that front. I think that we cannot underestimate the absolute belting he got at the Australian Open in the final. Right. And I just wonder how much confidence-wise that hurt his confidence. Because talk about over five sets, you would think that someone like Rafa could sort of work it out, right? I mean, he went into that final playing really good tennis, and he just got, just thrashed.
Right.
And it was like he just had nothing. His face told the story during the match. It was just like, what do I do? What do I do? And maybe you're starting to see the remnants of that coming into the clay court season now, not having the results that we're so used to him having. You start to wonder how much of his confidence was dented from that final and how much now the confidence is dented after these last couple of weeks.
Remember the Wimbledon semifinal against Djokovic, Nadal Djokovic.
Yeah.
And great, I mean, that's as good a match as I saw in 2018,
yep.
Deep into five sets.
Yep.
Players don't think about it all the time, or do they think it at the time, boy, if I win this match, this is going to do X for me, and if I lose this match, it's going to do Y. I mean,
I don't think you think about that on the court. I don't think you think, oh, if I win this match, it's going to, you know, propel me to have the most amazing year.
Or I'm looking at 18 majors, I've just beaten Djokovic,
yeah.
And now I'm closing in on Roger. I mean, a couple of points in that one.
Yeah.
You can say the same thing about the 2017 Australian Open final, but
yeah.
That match against Djokovic at Wimbledon. Yeah, exactly.
Shot.
I mean, that a matter
he still
of inches.
Remembers that shot.
Tennis history is on the smallest of axes. And yeah. I always think if Rafa wins that match against Djokovic in the Wimbledon semis, a lot of 2018 and a lot of that Australian Open final may have been written very differently.
Absolutely. I mean, you can make that argument with a lot of different players, you know, in their careers. I mean, if Grigor Dimitrov had sort of closed the door in that match at the Wimbledon, you know, years and years ago against Novak, that could have turned his career around to give him the belief that maybe he can win a slam. I don't know, and he lost that match. So, I mean, there's so many that you could look at like that. Could it have happened? Yeah, for sure. I mean, if he'd won that match at Wimbledon, certainly would have made a huge difference to win the French Open and Wimbledon, because probably guaranteed he would win the final just because Kevin was, you know, cactus, as we say in Australia, in the final after the Isner match. But, you know, I don't know. It's hard to say. I just think we can't look back, but we can look and learn from that match. And for me, the Australian Open loss, I think, really dented his confidence in a way that we haven't seen ever. And I'd never seen that before, ever.
That was such a weird match, too, because to that point, Nadal had been playing great.
That's what I mean. I mean, he went into the final
playing
beautiful,
unbelievable.
Matches, yeah. I mean, it wasn't like he went into the final sort of limping into the final,
exactly.
Oh, just getting through
exactly.
In five, or, you know, at times like, oh, he's not the same player. I mean, he went into the final, you're like, whoa, like these two are both playing unbelievable. This is going to be an epic game, right? It's all anybody could talk about in Australia. Oh, are we going to have the same as we did, you know, 5 years
the
ago?
The dream final.
Yeah, blah. Yeah. And it was just terrible.
Right.
It was just terrible.
Right.
You know, I think he should have won the match against Roger the previous, was it the previous year, the year before, when he had
a
break in the final.
Right,
and
right.
And that was the first time that I saw Rafa really get tight, like really tight. Like it was so obvious that he got nervous and, you know, Roger took advantage of that. And that was, Roger won that match, and what a year he had after that. So, you know, you could look back on maybe that could have changed things. I don't know, but we're just talking about now. We're talking about the French Open, and I think that this is the first time that we can honestly say Rafa goes into this massively with an unknown next to his name, which is extraordinary to think.
Man, so someone wrote to me on Twitter, who are you taking? Would you take Nadal versus the field?
I'd take the field.
And yeah, no, I was going to say, we don't even get to that point. You think there's a favorite, you're picking team.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I think that the field, listen, if Rafa ends up doing winning another one, it won't surprise me at all because, right. You know, he could work his way into a tournament and then once his confidence is up, I'm talking about the fact that he has to have very low confidence going into the French Open. After what happened to him in Australia, he did not have a good swing. You know, he pulled out of a lot of events on the hard court. Then he hasn't had the clay court build up. He still has some tournaments left. Like I said, I'll reserve my opinion until after Rome fully. But he goes into the French Open for the first time not being confident at all in himself and his tennis. And that we can never have said in the past.
Can
no matter what
up?
He did in the hard court season, right. He came into the French Open on
exactly.
fire.
Right, Clay Rafa.
That's
Clay
not
Rafa.
The case this
right.
time.
Let me ask you this. He will likely play, if he gets to the finals, he will likely play 6 matches on one court and one match on
Longland.
On a second court, on
yeah.
Longland.
Yeah.
How much of an advantage is that?
Oh, huge. Massive.
Why don't we talk? So thank you. I'm leading the witness.
Enormous.
Why don't we talk about that more?
It's enormous. And nobody talks about it. I mean, it's safe to say, look, if you go out and play on Philippe Chatrier against a player that's been out there a few times or a bunch of times, certainly it is good for them to have played out there. But if you've never played out there, or if you've only played once, maybe twice, it is such an advantage. The court is... The feel is different. The look is different. It, for the first 5 to 6 games as a player, you're telling yourself, keep your head down, stop looking around. Oh, my God, I'm on center court. Oh, my God, all these people. Right. Oh, the TVs are on me. I'm playing rough. That's all that's going through
but
your
not,
head.
Not even that.
No one will
just
admit
the
that.
Dimensions. I mean, just where am I
everything.
Standing? How much room do I have till I hit
everything.
The flower boxes?
Everything. Everything is so different. And... You know, certainly for young players, oh my God, I mean, it's just like overwhelming for them. But, you know, even for a veteran player that's never been out there. If you put Rafa on court 8 at Roland Garros, he would probably win 99.9% of the same matches that he's won on Philippe Chatrier as well.
Right.
Although he wouldn't have the room
to
run back,
to
that's
me,
for sure.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's returning from a different point. But I always want, I mean, Serena Williams at the U.S. Open, there is one court.
Yeah, one court.
On which she'll play.
One court.
I got to think that is an advantage.
That's a huge advantage. Massive. And so the court speeds are different.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing, too. It's only one court speed.
I wouldn't say that the court speed's necessarily... Well, it is a little bit different in Paris. It can change from Longland to Philippe Chatrier. It's a little bit harder, Longland, a little bit higher bounce, I think. If I can remember, it's been a while since I've played there. But they are still different, too, and that's unusual.
What about the guy who has not played a lot of clay court tennis over the last few years?
Roger?
Yes. What kind of chances do you give him at Paris?
I mean, I think he'll go deep, for sure. I think that, you know, this is a guy that you can pretty much write a ticket to the quarters straight away. Just because he's so good.
Best of 5.
I mean, he's best of 5. He's so good. He's going to talk about playing every match on one
right.
court. He will play every match on Chatrier.
Fan favorite. I mean, this is the major closest to, for what it's worth. I mean, he's popular anywhere he goes. But,
yeah,
you know,
matter.
He's 3-hour train ride from
talk
home.
About putting someone on court 8. Doesn't matter. You can put him on court 8 in Central Park here where he practices sometimes.
He's been there.
It doesn't matter. I mean, Roger's the most popular tennis player.
I mean,
player
is he a contender?
Yeah,
is
absolutely.
He, I mean,
absolutely. I mean, the only guy that's really negated him winning 5 or 6 French Opens is Rafael Nadal.
Right.
So, you know, if Rafa is certainly not at his absolute best, I mean, there's absolutely no question that Roger can win the French Open. No question. Once these top players get through the first week, which they will do, that's when you start going, okay, these are the guys that you expect to be there. Now, when you talk about the outsiders, like the teams and the Wawrinkas and these guys that really can do damage, they will certainly have a bigger say, I think, this year than they've ever had at the French Open.
You've not mentioned the name Alexander Zverev, who at this point last year, people wondered if the breakthrough was weeks away.
Yeah, and I'm a little... I mean, obviously, look, he had a great end of the year with what he did in London, but I'm surprised that with Lendl, you know, having been in his camp,
right.
Making a little bit more of a difference. I don't know. Look, he's still young. I have very high hopes for him in the future. I don't know what's going on physically, mentally, why he's not having the results that we expected him to have. But, you know, look, I'm not panicking about his future. I think it's going to be very bright, but
But no, yeah. Jamie. I mean, Jamie said this last week too, that he's, you know, he's 22.
Yeah,
that's
so
nothing
young.
Now. Now
he's
got
so
10 more
he
years.
Just looks
so
old. I don't know what it is.
He no, so he's well, there's a allegedly a dispute with an agent, and there's some off court stuff. Yeah. But it used to be, boy, if you don't start making inroads by, you know, Andre wins Wimbledon, it's just in the nick of time. And
yeah, I know, it's kind of crazy. But
crazy.
But I still think that tennis now is so different than what it was 10 years ago. You know,
10, 15 years ago,
and the fact that tennis is not a sprint anymore. You know, you used to have to try and sprint from 20 to
30. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, exactly.
You know, it was like literally, right. I mean, I remember, it's like when you were 28, you were like, oh my God, my tennis career is over soon. And it's like, no, you got another 10 years left. I mean, look at Roger, look at Serena and Venus and the results that they had in their mid to
well, even 30s. I would say that, but even like take a step, you know, next tier down. I mean, the Fabio Foninis of the world. I mean, there are a lot of sort of middle tier players.
That's what I mean. Well, there's so much
great.
Money now that they can afford to travel with more entourages. They can afford to travel with the trainer or physio or somebody to really help them maintain their body, and they can, and they're happier. I mean, that's one of the things that people don't talk about is that you kind of, especially for women, when you get into your 30s, you start thinking about, okay, I want to have kids, I want to have a family. And so you think, oh, shit, I can't do that at 39. I mean, you can. Certainly people are having kids into their late 30s and 40s, but, you know, the chances are it's a little bit harder. It's a little bit more difficult. Do I really want to have a kid at 40? So, you know, you have to weigh up those options as a woman. For the men, it's no big deal for them. I mean, they can have 10 kids and still be playing. So, and they probably want to get away from their home. I mean, I would think. I mean, Roger takes everyone with him, but he travels privately. So, hey, you know, it's easier for him.
Not sure anyone wants to leave 10 kids at home. No, but you're right. I mean, I think A, for sort
I don't think
of
anyone
career
wants
longevity.
To have 10 kids.
No, but for anti-aging type of, I mean, there's absolutely, there's also a financial incentive to keep, if you're picking a name, Feliciano Lopez.
Yeah, of course.
It's a good life. Why am I rushing the packet in?
But I think the thing prior to was when you were 30, 31, you weren't making the money that they're making now. So, you know, it was like, all right, let me focus on the other part of my life now. You know, whereas now, literally, 40 is the new 30 in tennis. Like, 40 is now, I think, becoming more of the retirement age for players than it was. 30 was definitely the retirement age 15 years ago
I think
for tennis players.
We all win.
So therefore, you better have won a Grand Slam by 21.
Right.
You only got
no,
9 years
left.
No, but
now I'm saying, yeah, exactly.
Which go quick.
Right.
They go quick.
Right. Well, 20 and 30. I mean, it used to be, you know, McEnroe, I don't think, won a major after he turned 25.
Well, that's my point.
No, but I think we all win, right? So the players, it's less pressure. They can prolong a career. You have a slump at 22 and big deal. I got 10 more years here. I think fans can have longer time to associate with players. Brands can have a longer time to associate with players. I think this is all...
It's all good.
Any reason not to this longevity?
I mean, the WTA, you know, put in that age eligibility rule for that reason. You know, we didn't want to see the Jennifer Capriati's retiring early and the Hinguses and Kim Clijsters and all these players that all quit at one point. Ash Barty. I mean, it's like there's been some unbelievable players that have retired and come back.
Right.
And, you know, now it's like, all right, if I get injured, there's no panic to come back too quickly because they know, look, I've got a long time. It's a marathon. It's not a sprint anymore.
All right, women's tennis.
Yeah.
Petra Kvitova is a two-time Wimbledon champion. You know what else she is? She is the only player in 2018
to win
multiple titles.
Yes,
so, A, this has kind of been a talking point for the last few weeks especially. Do we like this parity?
I do. I think it's great. I think it shows you the depth of women's tennis. I mean, do you want somebody winning a tournament every single week? Sure. You know, you build a superstar. You know, if Naomi Osaka kept winning after Australia, and you're just like, okay, she's the next thing.
Right.
I just think it's so much more difficult now. I think it's such a unique, special individual it takes to win week after week after week in Grand Slams because it's a lot of pressure. And now with social media and all this other extra stuff, I mean, every time I look at Naomi, she's doing some photo shoot or she's doing something else. It's like, oh my God, if you have people around you that can pull you back and literally stop you from doing a lot of that and focus on tennis only, it's hard though, because, you know, everyone around you is paid by you.
What do you make of her right now?
Naomi?
I mean, I find her to be at such a really interesting point in her. We're not talking about it. She goes to the French Open as a two-time defending great. She's going for a third straight major.
Yeah, we're not
She's
talking
switched
about
coaches. She's now with Nike. She's got a lot, as you say, a lot of obligations. At the same time, especially, and I think this came out a little bit in this lawsuit. I mean, she did not come from, not that long ago, she was not living a privileged existence.
No.
I would be doing the same thing.
Yeah.
You know what? If 3-4 years ago I was really struggling and suddenly came into vast wealth, I'd be doing that extra photo shoot too, I think.
Yeah, well, that's where you've got to have the people around you maybe to say, okay, yeah, but you're 21. You just won two back-to-back Grand Slams. You're fine. You just banked about probably $10 million with two tournament victories easily. I mean, when you're talking about prize money on top of her endorsements.
Well, and you and I both know this too. The Japan endorsement portfolio
exactly.
is a completely different set of numbers.
Just the sponsorship she would have got for the bonuses from Nike and from Yonex and Adidas at the time that she won those two Grand Slams would have been enormous. I mean, you can pretty much write probably a $10 million check for those two wins. So it's like money's fine. Like you're 21, like let's focus on what you need to be doing. I mean, when you look at Venus and when you look at Serena, let's use Serena as a backdrop because, you know, she looks up to Serena so much. Serena at 2019, 2021 was winning Grand Slams and all she wanted to do was win more. Like there was nothing that was going to stop her from winning more Grand Slams and more Grand Slams and more tournaments. And Steffi was the same way. Those people come along so rarely, John, anymore. You win a Grand Slam and you're like, I just want to win it. I mean, listen, Naomi wants to win another one. So does Petra. So does everybody else that's won a Grand Slam. But that undying necessity
right.
to not lose at a Grand Slam, I don't think it's there as much as it's not yeah, there some, right
you know,
now
someone,
with somebody.
I can't even remember who it was. Someone else said that on the podcast. Yeah. Like, no disrespect, but I don't sense this is unquenchable thirst
no.
that we see in other players.
And it's, you know, maybe because the money is so enormous that it takes over and because of social media and because of all the obligations that these people have now put on them, it's crazy how much they have to do. I mean, the press that they have to do and everything, it's so different. I mean, back when
press.
Steffi and, well, I mean, yeah, I mean, geez, you win a Grand Slam and you're there for, people don't see, you lift up that trophy, trust me, you don't right. even see your people for like 3 hours. You're like getting pulled from pillar to post after that. So, you know, there's a lot of responsibility on you when you win a slam.
What, I mean, Petra can play well on clay. She did not have a particularly good French Open last year, obviously, would be a terrific story.
Yeah. Well, she was my pick at Wimbledon.
Yeah, I was going to say, what are we...
She was my pick at Wimbledon last year and crashed out in the first round. The problem with Petra is that just as there's some days where she just has
yeah,
a bad
you're
day.
Totally right.
You know, the ball just flies right. off the racket long. She can't find the court. She just doesn't feel good. Something's missing.
The delta
she can
on
have
her
those
play,
days.
At majors especially.
But also, you know, she won Stuttgart, and I will say it's a perfect clay court for her. It's indoors. And
Stuttgart
we know
is,
that Petra
right.
Kvitova is probably the best indoor tennis player we've seen in the last decade. Every tournament she wins almost has a roof either available or over her.
But she, I mean, she won Madrid last year
again,
heading into the French.
But again, Madrid is a whole different... Whoever wins Madrid, I don't even look at them to be a contender for the French Open. I mean, I do, obviously, because they're great players and all great players win Madrid. But it's at altitude.
You don't think
the
it
ball's
has the
flying.
Predictive value?
No,
or,
okay. not at all. No, yeah. That's why Rome is more of,
right,
a,
right.
of a predictor.
Right.
Than Madrid. I mean, hello, did Rafa win Madrid one time in the 10 times that he's
right.
played it?
Yeah.
Because it's altitude, it's super quick, it actually favors really big service, and again, it's got a roof available to it. You really feel like you're playing indoors there. You don't feel like you're playing outside.
What,
and so that's why Petra, you know, won there last year, because it's perfect for her. It's why Roger won Madrid many, many times. It's perfect for him.
It's funny, we just had lunch, we were talking about Barty, and we were talking about, you know, Pliskova, who you worked with.
Yeah.
I don't think we mentioned Serena Williams once. What, where are you with that?
Well, you know, I mean, listen, when Serena enters a tournament, she's one of the favorites still because she knows how to win them and she knows how to navigate through a Grand Slam and a big tournament. But, you know, I follow her on Instagram and I follow her on Twitter and, you know, I see where she's what she's doing and where she's at and she's busy. She seems to be busy doing anything but on a tennis court. And I worry a little bit about that. You know, I do think to myself, God, I wonder if she practiced this morning. That's the first thing I think of. When does she get her practice in? When is she practicing? Because she's, you know, doing this photo shoot and she's, you know, doing her clothing line or she's doing a commercial. And I mean, good for her. I mean, she should be doing whatever the hell she wants to do.
Right.
You know, she's with Olympia or whatever's going on, but I don't see her very much on the practice court. So I'm like, God, if you want to contend, she knows better than anyone, you really got to spend a lot of time. And I'm not saying that she's not doing that. But what I see on in social media is that where does she find the time? It's incredible if she's practicing and getting ready for these tournaments and still doing what she's doing. She's a unicorn if she can do well.
How much of that is just what she's choosing to put on social media, though?
That's what I'm saying. I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm not like texting her and being like, hey, did you practice this morning? Or I feel like I'm not her coach, you know what I mean? But I see what she's doing right now, and she's working really hard off of the tennis court with all of her other stuff. And if she is working and practicing, my God, how does she do it all? It's incredible. She's a mom. She's doing all of this other stuff, and she's practicing and working out in the gym. Good God bless you, Serena, if you come out and play well on the clay court season, because you are an incredible human being if you can do that, and an athlete. I hope she is.
I was going to
say, she's up there at 6 in the morning practicing.
I mean, last year's French Open was so strange with that, where she looked really rusty.
Well,
right
on.
Out of the
base,
and then by the middle of the tournament, and then she played doubles with Venus, and then all of a sudden, by the middle of the tournament, 4 or 5 days in, you're just thinking, you know,
it catches up.
And then she suffered an injury playing doubles and pulled out against Sharapova.
It catches up with you if you haven't done.
But my point is,
the problem is if you haven't played a lot of matches.
Yeah,
people don't realize.
Big
practicing is one thing, and you can push yourself as hard as anyone can possibly practice. But as soon as you get on a match, it's a whole different story, because you're pushing yourself a little bit more, just naturally, and you're also a little more stressed, so the body's under more stress. So your body reacts differently, and it strains it more. And that's the issue, and Serena hasn't played a match now in a long time.
So people say that all the time. I can play practice sets till 2 in the morning. It's different.
True.
So what is it? Is it the scoreboard? Is it the,
stress.
Ball boys and the chair fish? But what specifically is the source of the stress?
It's a combination. It's the anxiety in your body.
Of
losing, of like being out there, and it really matters. I mean, in practice, when you're playing a set against another player, you're like, oh shit, I don't want to lose this set, or I don't want to get broken.
No,
I mean,
players say this all the time.
But you're not like,
right,
this is life and death. Like when you're out there in a Grand Slam and you're down break point, your body is like, and your brain is like ticking overtime. Oh my God, you know, and you see that drop shot and you run and you hustle and you reach out for it. In practice, you're like,
But need to run for that far? Drill deeper here. Is it the fact that they're saying advantage stubs? Is it the prize money? Is it that the results are going to be all over the internet? Is it the ranking? Like, what? When players say this all the time,
it's
right?
A list, right? You just put a list down.
But
and I ticked all of them.
Specifically, is it when
all
people
of it.
Say the matters? You cannot replicate the stress of a match, and you want to say, is it?
Okay, I'll tell you what it is.
Exactly?
It's like when you, for you know, the lame, you know, people at home that have never played in a Grand Slam or, you know, had this moment. It's like when you go to do a speech and you practice that speech in front of your family and your friends, and you know, it's nerve-wracking, right? You're like, okay, I don't want to mess this up, and you get it right, and you get it right, and you get it right, and then all of a sudden you walk onto the stage and bam, the lights go on. Ugh, it's like the pulse rate. You can feel it in your heart. You know, you can feel it in your neck. I've done this 100 times. I just did this in front of a light camera for practice. And then all of a sudden when they go 5, 4, on air in 3, 2, and they point at you and those lights go on, you're just like, ugh. It's similar in that respect. And, I mean, not everybody's going to do a speech in front of a million people and lights come on, but you kind of get that. But that's what it feels like. And it's just, there's just more on the line. There's just more on the line in every respect. So you run harder, you try harder, you have more nerves, and there's just more on the line.
You see all these injuries occur in matches that do the exact same movements I do in practice 1,000
times.
Tense. I mean,
you're tense. That's the best way to put it. Your body is way more tense. Because in practice, you know, it's not going to matter that much. Whereas in a match, it's everything.
All right, last question. You are well known for your doubles play. Grand Slam doubles champion. It's not a sea change, but we do seem to be seeing more and more singles players. Tsitsipas is an example on the men's side. We talked about Ash Barty. Mm-hmm. Are we getting to a point where we're going to see more and more singles players playing doubles? And what do you make of that?
Well, I hope so. Yeah, we are starting to see a little bit of that. I mean, we've had a smattering. You know, it's funny that you say this, because in the last 10 years, I would say, you know, a lot of players chose not to play too many doubles tournaments or matches. There's a smattering here and there that play Indian Wells and Miami and maybe some big tournaments where they have a little bit more time.
Right.
But man, when I played back in my day, don't you love that?
Oh,
when
people turned say into
that?
One of those?
I've turned into one of those. Everybody played. Everybody played singles and doubles. Arantxa Sanchez Vicario, number one in singles and doubles. Kim Clijsters, number one in singles
every
and doubles.
Every major, Venus and Serena.
Venus and Serena, I know. Every bloody time I'm playing a semi or a final, guess who I'm playing against? You know, that doesn't happen anymore. But it's like, you know, not that I'm bitter, but, you know, it's like when you think about, you know, the Natasha Zverevas and, I mean, Steffi won a Wimbledon doubles with Gabriella Sabatini, you know, Martina Navratilova, everybody played singles and doubles, you know, Ai Sugiyamas to Daniela Hantikova to all these great players. And the money got so much in singles that they just were like, yeah. And plus, here's the thing. nobody plays doubles anymore. Even the doubles players. They're all standing back on the baseline. They're just hitting and hitting and hitting. And
you see a lot of four players in the backcourt.
Honestly can say there's not one. There's about two or three true serve and volleyers that play doubles anymore. And everyone's like, well, the game's changed. No, it hasn't. The people that play classic doubles actually do very well. It's why Hingis was dominant when she came back. It's why someone like a Bethany Maddox-Sands does well in doubles, because she still moves and plays at the net like a doubles player. It's why, you know, Demi Schuurs has had a good couple, who would never make it on the singles tour, you know, has done well in the last year or two playing doubles, because she serves and volleys, and you're cutting angles. So for me, these players that are starting to play doubles again, like the Ashbardis, you know, Vika Azarenka has played a lot of doubles in the last 12 months coming back, mm-hmm. is that it teaches you how to cut angles, and it teaches you how to play and be a little bit more secure at the net. And I think that's vital when you're playing matches now, because there's so many players that would win so many more matches if they were more comfortable at the net. Bottom line, I mean, I can name 10 right now that I thought if they could come in and be a little bit more comfortable at the net, someone like a Sloane Stephens, you know, her volleys are okay. I mean, if she played a little more doubles, would she get more comfortable? I don't know. Madison Keys, these sort of players that have huge weapons on the back of the court, if they could just transition a little bit into the net, I mean, they could finish these points off so much easily.
What about what you were just saying before, though, about the stress of match play versus the stress of practice? That I think it's great. Azarenka's getting
all
this
match play. Well, that's the thing that Ash Barty loves.
Yeah, right.
She's
exactly.
like, I prefer to play a doubles match than go out and practice.
It's a good way to look at it.
You know what I mean? Right. Like, I mean, John McEnroe said that all the time. He'd rather go and play a doubles match than go and practice. I mean, who wants to practice? Practice sucks. You
we're
know, playing
about
a match
practice.
Is different. Exactly.
Let's, you've got to run uptown. We got to give up the studio. And most importantly, Jamie's sister.
I don't know.
Is about to give birth. Did I tell you that?
I know. I'm feeling stressed
become,
for you, Jamie. Do you know what it is? Is it a boy or a girl?
It's a girl.
Oh, nice. you can like take her dressing, you can take her shopping and all that.
Or she can play soccer like her aunt.
Oh there
nice.
You go.
What about tennis?
Wow. What about tennis?
Or tennis. Well,
tennis is a better sport for a girl.
Let them choose.
A lot more money.
All the sports. We will try all the sports. We will not single out.
Good. See? Oh, yeah. So
good.
The,
well, I did a lot
Dave
of sports
right
growing
there.
Up, so there you go.
You played other sports?
Oh, yeah. I played a lot of sports until I was about 11 or 12. Then I really started concentrating.
If tennis doesn't exist, what would you have played?
Golf.
As long as you didn't say that netball.
No, I did play netball, though. I was a center and I was goal defense. There's a lot of sports I could have played, I think.
We made it this far without talking tennis politics. I feel like this was like...
It's a miracle.
What do you call it? This was like in... What do they call it?
We're
it
a
like
unicorn.
A palate
We're
cleanser.
A unicorn podcast.
This was a palate cleanser. We have the French Open coming up in... 4 weeks from today, I think.
We didn't
Is
even
right?
talk about who's going to be the favorite at the French Open for the women. I mean...
Right, we're working on the assumption it's a wide-open field. All right, let's go back to that. What do you got?
Wide open field?
What do you got for the women?
Well, again, I want to see who wins Rome. I mean, for me... Who wins Rome is going to be the favorite. I think that Halep's back on the court. She's practicing. We'll see. She's incredibly comfortable on clay. This is where she's happiest. I think she's the favorite going into the French Open. I mean, I don't know what's going on with Sloane. I don't know what's going on there.
She's
I mean,
engaged.
Listen, I know. A happy engagement, too, Sloane to Josie. But Madison certainly put up her hand by winning Charleston. Not indicative to the clay in Paris.
I was going to say, that's like a Madrid situation.
A little bit, yes. But look, she made the semis last year. So she certainly knows how to play on clay. She loves sliding around there and she can use her weapons. And actually, clay sort of negates some of her like mistakes that she makes on other courts because she feels like she has to go for it.
She said that.
Whereas
she
on clay,
yeah.
she all of a sudden, her patience level is there. Because she knows I can still hit a winner from anywhere on this court, but I know that I also don't have to. So it sort of puts her in a more comfortable zone, being and especially Paris. Paris is fast. I mean, it's a fast clay court. So it's not like you have to be super defensive. So I think Madison will certainly be putting up her hand to go deep at the French. As I said, we'll see what happens with Sloane, what's going on there. But Halep is my favorite.
She is?
Yeah.
To defend?
Yeah.
Interesting. No, I'm kind of out of the prediction game with women. The one thing I will say...
Oh, no, isn't that fun, though?
The one thing I will say about this era in women's tennis, we can argue about whether parity is preferable, and that seems to be a big topic. I love the variety, though.
Mm, and me, too. We didn't even talk about Osaka. How's she going to do?
The clay is a little bit of a TBD. But, all right, let's do this again. Jamie's got to go attend the... birth of a
well, she's not the doctor. It's not like she's taking the baby out.
Jamie's got to catch a train. I've got to run. You've got to run.
I'm gonna run.
This was this was great though. I was happy to actually talk tennis for a bit.
Yeah, it's fun always. Thanks, John.
Thanks. All right, that does it for this week. Thanks as always to Jamie, our producer, who now has to run and go be an aunt. Thanks to Renee for popping in. Lower Manhattan resident Renee Stubbs. You can catch her commentary. She will be back in the coaching game soon. Always a pleasure to talk shop with her. Keep your guest suggestions coming, and we'll do it again next week. Take care, everyone.